Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going to start with current events. We're going to move into checking in on the royals, and we've got plenty of politics this week. So we're going to start off with what everybody's talking about, the Diddy trial. This is entitled Direct Examination, The Unsettling Spectacle of Cassie's Diddy Trial Testimony. In its earliest days, a broad racketeering conspiracy and sex trafficking case has zoomed in on a single relationship. This is by Dan Adler on May 15th. In November 2023, Cassandra Ventura sued Sean Combs for extensive sexual and physical abuse during their relationship. For more than a decade, the singer and hip-hop mogul, better known as Cassie and Diddy, were a reliable fixture of courtside seats and red carpets. The suit was settled within a day, with Combs denying any wrongdoing, but it immediately reframed this sunny portrait of the couple and of Combs himself. A year and a half later, with Combs standing trial in a Manhattan federal courthouse, Ventura remains the axis of the story that has enveloped her former partner. Her lawsuit set off a wave of further civil complaints, as well as a criminal indictment that largely mirrored her accusations, even as it set out a broader view of Combs' alleged violence and misconduct. Prosecutors charged Combs with racketeering conspiracy, sex trafficking, and transportation to engage in prostitution, claiming that he had used his business empire as a criminal enterprise to coerce Ventura and others into elaborate sexual performances with prostitutes, now known widely as what he called freak-offs. Combs has pleaded not guilty and denied any wrongdoing in connection with the civil suits he faces. Ventura is the prosecution's star witness and the defense's primary target. Earlier this week, one of Combs' attorneys requested that Ventura, 8 months pregnant with her third child, be seated in the witness box before the jury arrived for the beginning of her testimony. "Pregnancy is beautiful and wonderful," Mark Agnifilo told the judge. "It also is a source of potential sympathy." The judge denied the defense's request. In her opening statement on Monday, another of Combs' attorneys, Tenny Garagos, said that Ventura had been free in her relationship with Combs. "She was not coerced," Garagos told the jury. "When she left, there were no repercussions. She ran into the arms of a physical trainer Combs had hired to train her." Ventura's husband, Alex Fine, had been watching her testimony in the courtroom. As she testified, Ventura recounted in often excruciating detail the abuse she said she suffered at the hands of Combs. "I was just so young," she said, recalling the beginning of their relationship and its turn to sex. "I didn't even have the vocabulary for some of the things we talked about." Later, she said, Combs and escorts, at Combs' direction, would urinate in her mouth, sometimes causing her to choke. Ventura testified that Combs would instruct her to rub the escort's semen onto his body. The most graphic portions of Ventura's testimony have inevitably traveled the widest. The true crime podcaster, Stephanie Sue, who has attracted some measure of reprisal on social media for her exuberant coverage of the trial, said on Instagram on Tuesday that she needed to scale back her daily coverage. "Given the time and the severity of the information that's revealed and spoken about in court each day," Sue wrote, "we don't feel great rushing it just to get information out to you guys." In a letter to the judge in this case, Ventura's attorney, Douglas Wigder, said that the news organizations not be allowed to view videos of freak-offs that Combs allegedly used to keep Ventura quiet about his abuse. On Wednesday, the judge ruled that the footage would be shown to the jury only. "Unsealing these videos," Wigder wrote, "would essentially allow the media to carry out the very threats that Combs held over her." On the same topic, why the Diddy trial will be a content miner's dream. At this advanced stage of the social media and podcasting era, nearly every celebrity legal proceeding plays primarily as fodder for content. The case against Sean Combs will bring the dynamic to a new peak. This is by Dan Adler on May 12th. During jury selection for the trial of Sean Diddy Combs last week, Judge Arun Subramanian called the celebrity defense attorney Mark Garagos into his chambers for a lecture. Garagos co-hosts a podcast with TMZ founder Harvey Levin, and during a recent episode, he described the prosecutors trying Combs as a six-pack of white women. Garagos' daughter, Tenny, is on Combs' defense team, and Garagos, whose client list has included Lyle and Eric Menendez and Winona Ryder, told Subramanian that he is currently representing Combs' mother in an unspecified matter. According to the New York Post, he has been observing the Manhattan courtroom proceedings in Combs' case from the defendant's friends and family section. Subramanian told Garagos that his remark would not be tolerated in any court from any lawyer anywhere across the nation. Garagos said that Combs, with whom he speaks frequently, believes he's being targeted because he's black, and defended his commentary on the case. "It's an observation," Garagos said. Per the Post, Combs's lawyers have agreed not to argue in court that the star was targeted by the prosecution due to being black. To an extent, this is the rough shape of every celebrity-adjacent legal affair at this advanced stage of the social media and podcasting era. There are the courtroom proceedings, inevitably drier than understood in the public imagination, and then there are the observations. Combs has pleaded not guilty to charges of sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy, and with opening arguments slated for Monday, his trial will almost certainly bring the dynamic to a new peak. A year and a half ago, Combs' ex-girlfriend, Cassandra, Cassie Ventura, accused Combs of extensive sexual and physical abuse in a lawsuit. They settled quickly, and Combs denied any wrongdoing, as he has in response to a long series of civil suits filed against him in the time since. The complaint gave way to a kind of lexicon around Combs and the allegations against him, with the terms "diddy party" and "freak off" becoming commonplace, and baby oil and IV drips taking on newly sinister valences. The rapper and social media gadfly 50 Cent, who is also working on a documentary for Netflix about the accusations, saw his profile rise as the face of Combs' antagonism. Tenny Garagos played defense on TikTok. After leaving the courthouse following the second day of jury selection, Stephanie Sue, a leading true crime podcaster, recorded a video on the street as she ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, recalling her experience of the day. She discussed how intense it was to be in the same room as Combs, describing him as looking akin to koalas when they get fuzzy. Part of the appetite has to do with the particular nature of Combs' fame. Jury selection began on the same day as the Met Gala, where Combs, only a few years prior, had turned himself into the star of the show by sprawling across the carpeted museum stairs. He had long had what appeared to be an intuitive grasp on this sort of spectacle-making, and his white party in the Hamptons elevated him to what seemed to be his natural place. For a general audience, the original source of Combs' rise, his contributions to foundational moments in the development of hip-hop, is now secondary to the ambient sense of him as impresario, mogul, and connector. A recent headline in The Independent put the intrigue inherent in Combs' case plainly. The celebrities mentioned during Diddy's sex trafficking trial. As the Me Too movement picked up steam several years ago, the trials of high-profile men accused of sexual misconduct were often portrayed as broad cultural reckonings. In recent times, though, they have more readily played as fodder for content. As Subramanian and Garagos finished their exchange last week, the judge eventually took a lighter tone. "I'm going to be watching and I'm going to be listening," Subramanian said. "You have one more listener for your podcast." "As long as you subscribe," Garagos replied, "I'm all for it." In other celebrity court cases, the Menendez brothers on a possible path to freedom after 35 years. One of their lawyers talks next steps. After a dramatic day in court, Eric and Lyle are now eligible for parole. But Governor Gavin Newsom will have to weigh in. This is by Deanna Kizis on May 14th. Eric and Lyle Menendez were resentenced yesterday, making them eligible for parole. This comes after they've served 35 years in prison for killing their parents. "This was an absolutely horrific crime," Judge Michael V. Jessick said while giving his ruling, adding that he was nevertheless impressed by letters written on the brothers' behalf by corrections officials. The judge did not recommend that the brothers be freed, saying, "That's not for me to decide." However, he also said, "I do believe they've done enough over the last 35 years to get that chance." LA County DA Nathan Hochman had opposed the Menendez brothers' resentencing and possibility of being released from prison, saying that they had failed to come clean with the full extent of their criminal conduct. But Jessic reduced Eric and Lyle's former sentence, which was life in prison without the possibility of parole, and laid the groundwork for their potential release. During the court proceedings, both Eric and Lyle took responsibility for their crimes, with the latter reading a statement that said in part, "I killed my mom and dad. I make no excuses and also no justification." He added that he made the choice to reload, return to the den, and run up to my mother and shoot her in the head. In an exclusive interview with Vanity Fair, one of the brothers' attorneys, Michael Romano, who's also the director and founder of Three Strikes Project at Stanford Law School, talks about the significance of what happened in court yesterday and what we can expect going forward. Vanity Fair says, "We all just heard about the decision. The brothers were hoping for voluntary manslaughter, which would have meant that they could be released right away, but the judge didn't do that. What did they say after the hearing?" Michael Romano answers, "So Lyle, immediately afterwards, said, 'We're humbled, deeply humbled, grateful, and happy for our family.' Eric was standing right next to him, and they were like, 'What should we say? What should we say?' So they composed that line together, but Lyle actually uttered the words. How did they sound? They sounded happy, relieved. This has been incredibly stressful to them. You know, you think we're interested, but it's their lives. I think in some ways it's like, okay, now we could take a breath. I mean, obviously everybody wants to be freed immediately, but I think it's an incredible relief." Why do you think Judge Jessic said it wasn't up to him whether they should be released? I disagree with him. The legislature has given him the power to do this and to make that determination, and I think he could have and should have. Judges have no problem saying the appropriate punishment here is 10 years or 20 years or life or whatever it happens to be on day one. I think they're just as qualified to evaluate the justice of their punishment on day 2000. Eric and Lyle will now face parole boards. How much weight will the board's recommendation have? Governor Gavin Newsom has to rule. Even if the board said they should be released immediately, the governor could still take as long as he wants to actually release them. He could release them right then, the next day, whatever he wants. We assume that if the parole board says that they recommend their release, he will follow that, but he doesn't have to. As the resentencing hearing, the judge considered a risk assessment and said that the brothers are a moderate risk to the community. How important is this? Both Lyle and Eric had recent cell phone violations. I can tell you that the data shows that about 35% of people who have moderate risk assessment end up getting parole, okay? So would it be better if they had low risk? Yes, but they could have gotten high risk. Most people wouldn't be shocked that the brothers got their hands on a cell phone. We're all addicted to our cell phones. The logic of some parole board members who find the cell phones a big deal is as follows. They say, "Don't you know that you're about to be considered for resentencing?" The prisoner says, "Yes." And they say, "Isn't getting out of here the most important thing in your life?" And the prisoner says, "It is." So they say, "You tell us that you're not making bad decisions for yourself, that you have total impulse control, and yet you keep on breaking the rules even though you know it's bad for you." It's considered by some to show bad judgment, but I know that Instagram is bad for me, and yet I still go on at 10 at night. And the judge actually at one point said that he was not terribly moved by the cell phone thing. Will Eric and Lyle face the same parole board officials? No, different ones. Do you think that one really might get parole and another might not? It's very possible that they will have different outcomes, but even if they don't get parole, they could come back as early as 18 months for another parole hearing. What do Eric and Lyle have to do now? I think that they'll just put their heads down. In court, lawyers do 98% of the talking. At a parole hearing, it's going to be a 4 to 5 hour kind of interrogation, from everything about their childhood, to their crime, to the rule violations, to the program they've done, and their expressions of insight into their crimes. It's about trying to explain not only your crime, but your personal journey. How do you articulate that? How do you? I'm sure that they have a dozen friends who went through the parole process. There's some trap questions that sometimes the board asks, so you want to prepare for that. Like, tell us about something in prison that you didn't get caught doing. It's a catch-22, right? Because if you say, no, nothing, they're like, that's BS. You don't ordinarily take cases like Lyle and Eric's. Why did you take this one? We hope that other judges, the parole board, and the community at large realize that resentencing is an important part of the justice system. There are literally thousands of people who are serving unnecessarily long prison sentences who do not get this kind of attention. A lot of people change, grow, get rehabilitated in prison, and we should incentivize that. A lot of our clients are serving life sentences for shoplifting from Ralph's. But even people who do something as horrific as Eric and Lyle can do something to better themselves. Oh goodness, but wait, there's more. Gerard Depardieu gets an 18-month suspended prison sentence for sexual assault. The 76-year-old actor was found guilty by the Paris Criminal Court of two sexual assaults during the filming of Jean Becker's movie Les Volets Verts in 2021. His lawyer, Jeremy Assou, has announced that Depardieu will appeal the decision. This is by the French Vanity Fair on May 14th. Gerard Depardieu has long been regarded as a cinematic legend, especially in his native France. He was Jean-Claude in Les Versus, Cyrano de Bergerac, and Obélie, but Depardieu is now also a man convicted of two sexual assaults. The Paris Criminal Court has sentenced the 76-year-old actor to an 18-month suspended prison sentence with an additional two-year disqualification and registration in the National Database of Sexual Offenders. His lawyer, Jeremy Assou, who announced that Depardieu would appeal his conviction, strongly criticized the court's decision, arguing that from the moment you are implicated today in a so-called sexual assault case, you're automatically convicted. Depardieu has appeared in court from March 24th to 27th, looking thinner than usual and walking with difficulty. He was confronted by two complainants, Amelie, who's 54, and a set designer, and Sarah, 34, a third assistant director. Her first name was changed at her request. Both described him as a rude actor who created a hostile atmosphere on set, then slid his hands over the buttocks or breasts of these women during moments when potential witnesses were scarce. The assault on Amelie took place in an apartment on Avenue Mozart in the 16th arrondissement of Paris, which was being used for filming. At this point, he's sitting down, explained the set designer in court, and he closes his legs over me. He grabs me, puts his hands on me, he pinches me, he kneads in front of me, around me, and when I realize how strong he is, I feel that he's very strong, I feel held, I have flashes, his big face in front of me, very angry, very excited, he says, "Come and touch my big parasol." He touched my pubis, my buttocks over my clothes. He kneaded all those parts. And when he got to my breast, that's when I gasped, "My God." I tried to pull his hands away. He was holding me, terrifying me, looking like a madman. In her testimony, Sarah recalled three assaults, including one 20 days before Amelie's, that occurred in the middle of the night. At the time, the young woman was the third assistant and in charge of escorting the actors from their dressing rooms to the set. "I found myself alone with Gerard Depardieu while he was always had his bodyguard or his hairdressing team." She recounted that the two of them were crossing the small street to get around the square, a two-minute walk at most. And then, out of nowhere, she said, he put his hand on her buttocks. "It was a bit of a test to see if he could do it or not. I didn't say anything at the time. I was just shocked." Although she said she felt sick to her stomach, she didn't tell anyone, so as not to make any trouble. But she did text a friend. "Gerard has been touching me since yesterday." The actor has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. He claimed he wouldn't be able to clamp Amelie between his thighs. "Besides, I can't," he insisted during the trial. "We can do scenes if you like. With the belly I've got, I can't push anything between my thighs. I'm 76 years old. I weigh 150 kilograms. I'm not going to have fun putting my hand on someone's bottom. I'm not Emile Louis." During his testimony, Depardieu became muddled in his explanations and appeared unconvincing. The accused actor changed his reasons for his actions and for the apologies he had offered to the two women. In police custody, Depardieu asserted that he had never touched Amelie. In court, however, he admitted to having grabbed her by the hips so as not to fall. But then this raised the question, why did he apologize to her a few days after the alleged incident? Depardieu said it was because of a simple verbal exchange. He'd given her a dressing down because she wasn't doing her job properly. But Amelie's reaction and that of the film crew doesn't amount to a simple shouting match, insisted the prosecutor. Similar questions could be applied to Depardieu's reaction to Sarah. Why did he apologize to her on the set of Les Volets Verts and tell her, "I won't come near you again"? As he awaits the appeal process, Depardieu also remains under threat of a rape trial following the complaint lodged by Charlotte Arnold in 2018, which was reopened in 2020 and remains under investigation. Depardieu has denied the allegation. He's also under investigation for aggravated tax fraud and money laundering, which his lawyers have denied. Surrounded by court cases, the actor's career appears to be in its death throes. Even so, Depardieu was spotted earlier this month in the Azores shooting the film, something in French, directed by Fanny Ardant, who has remained his friend and supporter. Let's check in on the royals. Meghan Markle and Prince Harry have a quieter date night at a James Taylor concert. The Duchess showed off her love for the Golden Oldies at a Santa Barbara concert this weekend, where the singer signed a copy of his Sweet Baby James book for the couple to take home. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on May 15th. This week, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry made an appearance backstage with James Taylor, the singer-songwriter whose classic 60s folk sound put him right in line with Meghan's yacht rock musical taste. For the couple's second concert in a single week, the Duke and Duchess went to a Santa Barbara Bowl to see Taylor, and on Instagram, Meghan shared photos of their backstage meetup along with the caption, "In my concert era." In the photos, the musician is shown signing copies of his 2018 children's book, Sweet Baby James, and posing with Meghan and a beanie-clad Harry. Meghan's outfit was more low-key when compared to the yeehaw-appropriate denim dress she wore to a Beyoncé concert last weekend, but the smile on her face was just as big. She might be a very modern duchess, but she has a deep and abiding love for throwback habits and hobbies. From hospitality to calligraphy, the Duchess is in love with the old world. Ever since she starred in her first lifestyle website, The Tig, Meghan has been enthusiastic about her love of oldies music, along with the more gentle picks from the 2000s, like guitarist Jack Johnson. It was even expressed on her wedding day. In the 2022 docuseries, Harry and Meghan, she said that she listened to Going to the Chapel by the Dixie Cups after she woke up on her wedding morning. During the service, she walked down the aisle to This Little Light of Mine, a gospel song that became a popular standard in the 1960s. In an interview for the Godmother's Bookstore Substack earlier this year, Meghan said that her mother, Doria Ragland, inspired her love for Taylor and other music from the era. "There was a lot of Joni Mitchell, Boz Scaggs, and James Taylor in my house growing up," said the Duchess. "There was also a lot of Anita Baker playing in the car on the drive to school. I was exposed to what my mom listened to versus kids' music, and I'm sure that informed my eclectic taste in music, lyrics, and rhythm and soul." During her Netflix show, With Love, Meghan, the music was very relaxing, and the Duchess even said that she loves to listen to yacht rock, the modern term for the type of soft rock that reached the heights of the popularity in the 1970s, like Michael McDonald, Christopher Cross, Steely Dan, and Kenny Loggins. In the Godmother's interview, she said she intentionally wanted the show to reflect her personal taste in music. "I love happy sing-along music that you can dance to in the kitchen, and I made sure that was represented in With Love, Meghan on Netflix," she said. "That's still reflected in what I play at home. The Beach Boys, The Supremes, Otis Redding, even Annette Funicello for fun pool party music when the kids have a play date." And in other royal news, Kate Middleton presents the Queen Elizabeth II Award for British Design in a stylish Victoria Beckham suit. For the outing in London on Tuesday, the Princess of Wales wore an olive suit and silk blouse by the singer-turned-fashion mogul. This is by Harriet Johnston on May 14th. Kate Middleton was effortlessly elegant in an olive-green suit as she presented a fashion award honoring British design and named after the late Queen Elizabeth II on Tuesday. The Princess of Wales, who herself is known for her thrifty sense of fashion and love for high street designs, opted for a smart two-piece suit by Victoria Beckham, which she paired with a statement blouse as she attended the event at London's 180 Studios. She was in attendance to present the Queen Elizabeth II Award for British Design at an event hosted by the British Fashion Council to celebrate the impact of young British creatives and the UK's thriving fashion industry. and recognize designers who are leading the way in sustainable practices and making a positive impact on the environment. Now in its eighth year, the award aims to provide continuing recognition of the cultural and trade role the British design and fashion industry has played from the start of Queen Elizabeth II's reign until the present day. Each year, it's presented to an emerging British fashion designer who shows exceptional talent and originality whilst demonstrating value to the community and strong sustainable policies. At the event, Princess Kate visited the winning designer's pop-up studio and saw how their sustainable designs are created. Following this, the princess met and viewed designs of recipients and shortlisted designers from the BFC Foundation's designer initiatives. These initiatives are funded by the BFC Foundation, which support the future growth and success of the British fashion industry by focusing on education, grant giving, and business mentoring. The funds provide designers with crucial financial support, showcasing opportunities, and mentoring as they work to build their brands. Princess Kate then presented the Queen Elizabeth II Award for British Design along BFC CEOs Caroline Rush and Laura Weir. The Queen Elizabeth II Award for British Design was first announced and presented to Richard Quinn in February 2018 when Queen Elizabeth II made her first visit to London Fashion Week. The award provides a legacy of support for the industry in recognition of the role fashion played throughout the late Queen's reign and continues to play in diplomacy, culture, and communications. Her Royal Highness previously presented the award to British menswear designer Saul Nash in 2022. This next article is going to bridge our way into the politics section. The Catholic right is deeply divided over Pope Leo and what his papacy will do. After an initial MAGA freakout, a number of Francis antagonists appear open to his successor. Though as Leo performs his inaugural mass this Sunday with J.D. Vance on hand, some church watchers warn that conservatives' tolerance is unlikely to last. This is by Catherine Joyce on May 16th. When Pope Francis died the morning after Easter, prominent right-wing Catholics leapt at the chance to lobby for a more conservative, even Trumpian, leader of the church. Far-right pundit Jack Posobiec broadcast a call for traditionalist Catholics to hop a flight to Rome right now, go into St. Peter's Square, and start taking up space, reminding cardinals voting in the conclave that would elect the new pope that now is the time for the traditional ascendance because we are in a traditional awakening here in the Western Church. Steve Bannon, who had castigated Francis for years, similarly vowed to organize an online show of force of traditionalists ahead of the conclave. In Rome, Catholic right journalists distributed a report to cardinals profiling leading papal candidates from a palpably conservative perspective, while U.S. Catholic right philanthropists courted church leaders at upscale gatherings, with one VIP saying their network could raise $1 billion to help the church, so long as we have the right pope. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're currently reading from vanityfair.com and an article about the new Pope Leo XIV. Let's continue. But on May 8th, when the new pope the conclave had chosen, Pope Leo XIV, formerly Chicago-born Cardinal Robert Prevost, and the first U.S.-born pope in two millennia of church history, appeared on the Vatican balcony instead, the Catholic right's fervor shifted to despair and alarm. "I can't believe the cardinals did this," said popular traditionalist Catholic podcaster Taylor Marshall, author of a 2019 book arguing that the election of the late Pope Francis was part of a century-old plot to undermine the church, as more than 100,000 viewers turned into his live stream. "Leo was definitely on the Pope Francis trajectory," he continued, "and given his comparative youth, his papacy could be a long one." Marshall's audience chimed in with their own lamentations that the Vatican had bucked conventional wisdom in picking an American pope so he could go head-to-head with Donald Trump, or fight to restore funding for Catholic relief work the Trump administration had cut. That the Pope-Trump stunt Trump declaring himself his own first pick for pontiff and subsequently posting an AI-generated image of himself in full papal regalia sitting on a golden throne had backfired, hurting conservatives' chances. Almost immediately, conservatives began poring over a since-deleted X account that appeared to belong to Prevost, reporting back with dismay that he'd shared posts expressing prayers for George Floyd, criticism of Trump's native rhetoric, and support for Dreamers, environmental advocacy, and gun safety laws. In recent months, he'd shared an article from the progressive National Catholic Reporter titled, J.D. Vance is Wrong, Jesus Doesn't Ask Us to Rank Our Love for Others, in response to Vance's invocation of ancient Catholic theology to justify Trump's mass deportation campaign, and an op-ed remonstrating Catholics who were indifferent to migrant suffering. They dug deeper and found that Prevost may have been involved in the removal of Bishop Joseph Strickland from his Texas diocese in 2023, following years of attacks on Pope Francis. And they unhappily registered in his first public address as Pope, Leo not only praised his predecessor, but also called for a synodal church, continuing Francis's vision of lay Catholics and church leaders working together to address important issues. Even one of Leo's brothers, speaking to media shortly after the announcement, said the new pope likely wouldn't represent much of a break in the tradition of Pope Francis. As consensus grew that the conclave had found in Leo a continuity pope, prominent Catholic right groups and figures voiced their outrage. The right-wing Lepanto Institute, a research organization that states it was created to present the facts about dissident and apostate Catholics in politics and other prominent arenas, responded to Leo's election posting, "Prevost, dear God, help us all," and subsequently declaring Leo as a James Martin pick in reference to Jesuit priest Friar James Martin, an advocate for LGBTQ inclusion in the church. Friar James Altman, who gained notoriety in 2020 for a viral video warning that Catholic Democrats would have to repent or face the fires of hell, wrote, "The vast majority of the hierarchy have betrayed and abandoned us once again." Catholic right outlet LifeSite News mournfully concluded, "The man who oversaw the takedown of Bishop Strickland and the rise of Francis ally Cardinal Robert McElroy has been handed the keys of Peter. The storm is here." While a handful of Catholic right voices counseled patience, Michael Matt, editor of The Remnant, urged followers to consider how a centrist pope might keep the traditionalist Catholic movement united, avoiding the factionalization that could follow the election of a more conservative pope. Other commentators, in and out of the church, proclaimed Leo's election an intentional rebuke of the MAGA movement. Far-right social media personality Mike Cernovich called Leo a shitlib. Trump ally Laura Loomer went with woke Marxist pope. In his live stream from Rome shortly after Leo was announced, Prosobiec said, "The choice of an American pope is clearly a reaction to President Trump." Marshall suggested Leo's election was an intentional effort to force U.S. traditionalist Catholics into a choice. "We as Catholics are going to be pitted against an American pope and the American president. And I feel the liberals, the bishops, the priests are going to be pushing us. Which one are you for? Do you support your president or do you support your pope?" Bannon reportedly declared Leo the worst pick for MAGA Catholics and an anti-Trump pope, selected by the globalists that run the Curia, subsequently telling the Financial Times audience, to laughter, that the conclave was more rigged than the 2020 election and would soon cause a schism. And then, almost overnight, the narrative seemed to change. On Friday, Marshall's video responding to Leo's election was no longer public on YouTube. In an earlier video, Marshall had also declared Prevost potentially the worst-case scenario. He posted a new recording that began with the words, "I submit myself to His Holiness, Pope Leo XIV. After prayer, he said, his initial shock had given way to a sense of encouragement, and he reminded listeners of historical cases where popes elected as liberal reformers had unexpectedly become staunch conservatives. Noting that Leo's papacy might last 20 years, he said Leo needs to know that traditional Catholics are praying for him, that we wish him the best. Other Catholic Right podcasts issued apologies and retractions for their initial response to the news, declaring a ceasefire in traditionalists' decade-long war against the hierarchy of their church, with one titling an episode, Softening Our Trad Hearts to Leo XIV. LifeSite News, which for years has published some of the most strident attacks on Pope Francis, declared it would not begin from a place of suspicion or opposition. The Lepanto Institute wrote, "It's like finally being able to breathe for the first time in 12 years." There seemed to be a number of explanations for the turnaround. Shortly after Leo's papacy was announced, two of the most conservative cardinals in the church, Raymond Burke and Robert Serra, who'd been among Francis's leading critics, released statements celebrating the new pope or approvingly quoted him on social media. A third, Cardinal Gerhard Ludwig Müller, who before the conclave had warned that failure to elect an Orthodox pope would lead to schism, told reporters that Leo's election had left everyone content. A new narrative began to emerge that a conservative bloc in the Vatican had allegedly formed an organized resistance to block progressive candidates, and that U.S. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Trump's second choice for pope, had served as kingmaker. Reporting in Italian media claimed that ahead of the conclave, then Cardinal Prevost had been seen entering Burke's Rome apartment for a top secret summit. Although subsequent reporting in the National Catholic Register that Burke had never received Prevost at his apartment cast this in doubt, the rumor had already spread widely online, prompting traditionalists to surmise that deals had been made and assurances given. Rumors also spread that anonymous sources had witnessed then-Cardinal Prevost preside over a private traditional Latin Mass, sparking hopes that he, as Pope, might rescind restrictions Francis had put on the liturgical form, which had become overwhelmingly associated with his opponents on the Catholic right. Conservatives dug up additional social media posts Prevost had shared, supporting conservative priorities. Not to mention that Leo wore the formal papal regalia Francis had scorned, that he spoke and sang in Latin, and that he would live in the apostolic palace rather than the Vatican guesthouse Francis had chosen. J.D. Vance, who will lead the U.S. delegation to Vatican City for Leo's inaugural Mass on Sunday, which also includes Secretary of State Marco Rubio, said he didn't want to play the politicization of the Pope game. Telling conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt last week, "I'm sure he's going to say a lot of things that I love. I'm sure he'll say some things that I disagree with, but I'll continue to pray for him and the church despite it all and through it all." Let's talk about some political current events. Trump's luxury jet from Qatar is a very dangerous situation, says former Bush ethics czar. Think of what would have happened in World War II if the German and Italian governments were able to give lavish gifts to American politicians. This is by Eric Lutz on May 12th. The luxury jet Donald Trump is set to receive from Qatar wouldn't just be a massive ethics violation. Foreign influence with extra legroom, as Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer quipped Sunday, it comes with dangerous implications for national security. Think of what would have happened in World War II if the German and Italian governments were able to give lavish gifts to American politicians. As Richard Painter, who served as ethics czar in George W. Bush's White House, put it to me Monday, it's a very dangerous situation. ABC News reported Sunday that Trump, who toured the plane in February, planned to accept a Boeing 747-8 jumbo jet from Qatar's royal family for use as Air Force One. It would then be transferred to Trump's Presidential Library Foundation, allowing him to use it personally when he leaves office. All told, the estimated $400 million jet, which has been described as a flying palace, would represent perhaps the largest ever gift to the U.S. from a foreign government. It comes as Trump's family business deepens its ties to the Middle East, and as Trump visits the region this week for the first international trip of his second term. Trump defended the Qatar gift Sunday evening, claiming it was a very public and transparent transaction. But the lavish gift raises the specter of a foreign government buying influence over the U.S., an especially concerning prospect in this instance, given Qatar's record of human rights abuses and financial support for Hamas. Accepting a luxury jet from any country is unconstitutional, Painter said, but this country has literally supported a terrorist organization. Democrats, meanwhile, have vowed to fight the transaction. On Sunday, Congressman Jamie Raskin, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, called on Trump to seek congressional approval as required by the Constitution. A gift you can use for 4 years and then deposit in your library is still a gift and a grift, Raskin wrote. New York Representative Richie Torres went even further, calling for an investigation into the flying grift in a letter to the Comptroller General of the United States Government Accountability Office, the Acting Director of the Office of Government Ethics, and the Acting Inspector General of the Department of Defense. The American presidency is not a personal inheritance. It does not exist to enrich Donald Trump, Torres wrote. It belongs to we the people. If we fail to draw the line here, there may soon be no line left to draw. And Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy vowed to block weapon sales to any country doing personal business with Trump, citing the United Arab Emirates' investment in Trump's crypto endeavor and the Qatari plane as unacceptable corruption of our foreign policy. But it remains to be seen if Democrats, who hold the minority in the House and Senate, can take concrete steps to block the move without GOP support. Trump dismissed his critics in a Sunday night social media post as world-class losers, and Republicans, to this point, have mainly refused to exert their legislative authority to meaningfully check Trump's power. Trump's Attorney General, Pam Bondi, who has her own ties to Qatar, has reportedly greenlit the transaction as legally permissible. But what is clear is that not everyone in Trump's inner circle is on board. This is really going to be such a stain on the admin, if this is true, posted Laura Loomer, the right-wing conspiracy theorist who has exerted considerable influence over Trump. And I say that as someone who would take a bullet for Trump. Next up, RFK to Congress. I don't think people should be taking medical advice from me. Yes, this is by Issy Lepowski on May 14th. In a hearing before the House Appropriations Committee on Wednesday, the nation's top health official, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., repeatedly ducked questions about whether he would vaccinate his kids if he had to decide today. The question came from Wisconsin Democrat Mark Pocan, who promised not to hit Kennedy with any gotcha questions before setting off a revealing exchange that went right for the jugular. You've previously said you vaccinated your children, Pocan asked. If you had a child today, would you vaccinate that child for measles? Kennedy took a few beats. For measles? Probably for measles, he sputtered before shifting the approach. I don't think people should be taking medical advice from me. Would you vaccinate your child against chickenpox? Pocan pushed. I don't want to give advice, Kennedy replied, before effectively doing just that by launching into a brief tutorial on disproven concerns that the chickenpox vaccine leads to upticks in shingles in older people. What about polio? Pocan asked. Kennedy answered the same way. Kennedy called his views on vaccines irrelevant, which, as a lawyer with no real medical experience, should be true. The problem is Kennedy has spent so very much of his adult life trying to make his often unfounded views on vaccines relevant that he's now been put in charge of the government agency whose job it is to oversee vaccine recommendations. That Kennedy has been so widely successful at doling out unsolicited advice on vaccines is all of our burden to bear. The least he could do is answer for it under oath. The vaccination question wasn't the only one Kennedy tried to evade to baffling effect, though. Ranking member Rosa DeLauro repeatedly pressed Kennedy on whether he would spend the funding for the National Institutes of Health, which Congress has appropriated despite the Trump administration's $20 billion proposed cuts. If you appropriate the funds, I'm going to spend them, Kennedy said. We have, DeLauro snapped back. Congress appropriated it. It passed into law. It's part of the 2024 budget, and we're under a continuing resolution that has adopted the 2024 numbers. How, then, can you justify cutting $20 billion from the biomedical research budget? If you appropriate the money to me, I'm going to spend that, Kennedy answered, as if he hadn't heard her. We have appropriated it, Mr. Secretary, DeLauro replied, appearing increasingly incensed. The Kafka-esque exchange went on for roughly 3 minutes before DeLauro relented and moved on. Unbelievable, she muttered. But it wasn't just Democrats pushing back on Kennedy. Republican Representative Mike Simpson of Idaho, a former practicing dentist, questioned Kennedy's frequent criticism of fluoride and the Food and Drug Administration's move to ban fluoride supplements for kids. "I want to see the studies on this and where we're headed," he said. "If Kennedy is successful in his takedown of fluoride," Simpson warned, "we better put a lot more money into dental education because we're going to need a whole lot more dentists." Next headline, Trump administration plans not to recommend COVID-19 vaccines for pregnant people, teenagers, and children. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, who leads the Department of Health and Human Services, will soon announce the changes to the vaccine schedule. This is by Katie Hirschenroeder on May 17th. In the coming days, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is poised to announce that the Department of Health and Human Services will no longer recommend COVID-19 vaccines for children and pregnant people, according to reporting from the Wall Street Journal. Something just happened that's really special. Leland Lehrman, the executive director of a new Make America Healthy Again affiliated think tank called the MAHA Institute, told attendees at a day-long event for the Institute on Thursday. "I was asked to please make this announcement," he continued, according to STAT. "You might have heard already, but today the secretary is announcing that HHS and the CDC are going to stop recommending routine COVID shots for children and pregnant women." The room applauded. Lehrman said, laughing, "That's good. That's really good." The MAHA Institute, officially launched this week, is the latest spin-off group by Kennedy supporters. According to STAT, the first event for the group featured a crowd including numerous figures with controversial views, including proponents of raw milk, union leaders against vaccine mandates, and psychiatrists who want to wean patients off mental health drugs. HHS halting the long-held recommendation for children over 6 months old and pregnant people to get one of the approved COVID vaccines is the latest example of the department, stewarded by RFK Jr., opting for skeptical messaging around vaccine efficacy and safety. Spokespeople for HHS, the CDC, and the White House didn't immediately respond to the Wall Street Journal's request for comment. STAT also attempted to reach HHS for comment. The health department's expected move to stop recommending the COVID vaccine to pregnant people, teenagers, and children could further endanger immunocompromised people across the nation, according to Richard Hughes, a lawyer and vaccine advocate. "Doing so would have a behavioral impact on whether people choose to get vaccinated," he told the Wall Street Journal. "If HHS is no longer recommending routine vaccinations for COVID for these groups, insurance companies will no longer have to cover these vaccines," Dorit Rice, a law professor who studies the anti-vaccine movement, said to STAT's Isabella Cueto. Kennedy, before and after joining President Donald Trump's administration, continuously spreads misinformation about vaccines, amplifies anti-science solutions to medical ailments, and sows doubt about widely used vaccines, including those to protect against coronaviruses. In 2021, RFK Jr. asked the federal government to revoke its emergency authorization of all COVID vaccines, filing a citizen petition on behalf of the Children's Health Defense, a Kennedy-founded group that advocates against the recommended vaccine schedule for children. Since taking on the role as health secretary, following his failed presidential campaign, Kennedy and his department have tried to discredit the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention research, which found that increases in autism diagnoses are largely due to broader screening and identification of people in previously under-identified groups, and not, as RFK Jr. has advanced, due to the MMR vaccine. In March, the CDC rolled back $11.4 billion in funds for state and community health programs that, in part, include immunizations and vaccines for children. And, in May, announced that all new vaccines would need to undergo placebo testing, a requirement that is likely to delay the availability of certain vaccines and complicate the process of getting vaccines approved. One legacy already forming for Kennedy is how he's handled the ongoing measles outbreak started in West Texas. According to the Texas Department of State Health Services, 718 cases have been confirmed since last January, and there have been two confirmed deaths, two young girls, ages 6 and 8. As unvaccinated people continue to spread the disease, many of them from the Mennonite community at the epicenter of the outbreak, Kennedy has continued to amplify untested theories about how to fight measles without vaccinations, like steroids, antibiotics, and cod liver oil. This week, Kennedy said during testimony before a House panel that he would probably vaccinate his child for measles if he had one today. During that same panel on Wednesday, Kennedy said, "I don't think people should be taking medical advice from me." Also at the Maha Institute conference on Thursday was Mary Holland, president of the Children's Health Defense. She was celebrating with attendees that the group's ideas have reached such a stage as this. "Wow, we've come a long way," Holland said. "We have all been waiting for this moment." Our next headline is by Izzy Lepowski. The uproar over James Comey's Instagram post is dumb and could get dangerous. Trump World is treating a beach photo of seashells spelling 8647 like a coded assassination order. The outrage is absurd, and it's also a pretext for something more sinister, punishing Trump's enemies. Donald Trump once suggested that Second Amendment people were the only ones who could stop Hillary Clinton. He mused last summer about how Liz Cheney might feel when guns are trained on her face. He said at a rally that to shoot him, someone would need to shoot through the media, and I don't mind that so much. And when asked by ABC News' Jonathan Carl what he thought of the January 6th rioters chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," Trump responded simply, "Well, the people were very angry." So excuse us for being a little incredulous that Trump is now accusing former FBI Director James Comey of putting a hit on him when he posted on Instagram photo Thursday of seashells on the beach arranged to spell out 8647. The number 86 is most commonly defined as meaning to throw out or to get rid of, but Trump World skipped right over those more obvious definitions and decided Comey's message could only mean one thing. "Just James Comey casually calling for my dad to be murdered," Donald Trump Jr. posted on X. Comey quickly took the post down, writing in a statement on Instagram that he didn't realize some folks associate those numbers with violence and that he opposes violence of any kind. Comey didn't respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. By Thursday night, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem had announced an investigation into Comey's alleged call for the assassination of POTUS Trump, and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard was called for Comey's imprisonment. On Friday, Trump himself was making the most of it on Fox News. "He knew exactly what that meant. A child knows what that meant," Trump said. "That meant assassination." Was it dumb of Comey to post a message so primed for willful misinterpretation by the right, particularly when they've played this same game of dictionary roulette with Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer? Yes. Is it just as dumb for the Trump administration to willfully misinterpret a seashell message as a death threat? Also, yes. Is it extra dumb that this ordeal has America frantically Googling the definition of 86 like we, as a nation, are all about to give the world's worst best man speech? You bet. Merriam-Webster President Gregory Barlow told Vanity Fair that as of Friday morning, 86 was the most frequently searched term on its website. According to Barlow, their research shows it probably comes from the 1930s soda counters, where it began as rhyming slang of nix, which meant to veto or to reject. The irony, of course, is that no one has accused the liberal pearl clutchers of stirring up faux outrage over semantics more than Trump. Of course, he wasn't suggesting Second Amendment people shoot Clinton. His 2016 campaign argued he was just encouraging them to vote. He wasn't calling for Cheney to face a firing squad. He was pointing out that warmongers like Liz Cheney are very quick to start wars and send other Americans to fight them rather than go into combat themselves, his 2024 campaign said. But the problem with this administration is that just because something's dumb doesn't mean it's not dangerous. The outrage over Comey's post is a mere pretext for the Trump administration to do what it has established a solid track record of doing, making perceived political enemies pay for their words. Last month, the president ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi, as well as Noam, to investigate Chris Krebs, the former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, who countered Trump's unfounded claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Trump has ordered another investigation into former DHS official Miles Taylor, who served in his first administration and wrote an anonymous book warning about Trump's dangers. And earlier this month, the FBI also opened a criminal investigation into New York Attorney General Letitia James, who prosecuted Trump in a civil fraud case for alleged mortgage fraud. James has denied the allegations. Whatever the finding of these investigations turn out to be, the fact that they exist at all has real consequences for their targets. Krebs has left his job, saying that fighting the order would require his complete focus and energy. Taylor told NBC News that he's received a barrage of death threats and has been told by security experts to update his will. "People need to know how real it is to be blacklisted by the president," Taylor said. "What I worry about is that they will try to use this tactic, this bludgeon of the bully pulpit of the presidency, to go shut people up." Meanwhile, Tufts student Rumeysa Ozturk has only just been freed from 6 weeks in federal detention after being snatched off the street for the apparent offense of writing an op-ed criticizing her university's response to the war in Gaza. Other international students, including Mohammed Khalil, have similarly been detained for their speech and remain in custody or have been forced to leave the country. "We now live in a world in which the president pardons people convicted of actual political violence and, incidentally, also rape and sexual abuse of a child, as long as they support him, while simultaneously casting a seashell message from someone who doesn't as the highest crime of all. If recent history is any indication, Comey's problems have just begun." We're going to end with Toni Collette answering the Proust questionnaire. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Chastity. Pointless. Who came up with that? On what occasion do you lie? To my dentist about the regularity of my flossing. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Floating on my back in the ocean. What's your greatest extravagance? Flights to Italy. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? This is the best thing I've ever eaten, and hilarious, and Arlo, get off your phone. Which living person do you most admire? Anyone brave enough to be truly themselves. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm terribly impatient. What is your greatest fear? Losing my mind. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People-pleasing. Which living person do you most despise? Ignorant presidents, plural. What is your current state of mind? Post-acupuncture stoned. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Maybe we'd add a cat, a pig, some chickens? If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? An effective peacemaker. What is your most marked characteristic? For better or worse, I am somewhat impulsive. What is your motto? Keep your heart open. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Have a great week, everybody.